Remember what we are doing. We are commenting on the Holy Father's apostolic exhortation called Vita Consecrata. We're going through a series of questions raised by what I consider the single most incisive document on consecrated life in papal history. So far, we have been looking at the variety of forms of consecrated life, and there are still a few more left. The present one reads, what are secular institutes? In general, a secular institute is an institute of consecrated life whose members bind themselves under vow to live out the evangelical counsels. What are some differences between secular institutes and, say, religious institutes? Begun in the 30s of this century, secular institutes, by definition, are in the saeculum, in the world. Their members live among the people with almost no exception. Members of secular institutes are not identifiable by their contemporaries. They engage in, well, secular either professions, medical, legal profession, teaching. However, in some enterprise that is deeply involved and by preference with influential people. They have superiors, often at some distance from where they, the members of the institutes, live. They are bound by the vows, including the vow of poverty, although they may be earning a fabulous salary, but they turn that in. There are not many members of secular institutes in the Catholic Church, even to this day, 60 years some after they were founded. Over the years, ever council members of secular institutes, I have found out it is not easy. What a mild statement. It's not easy for members of secular institutes to live up to the vows of consecrated chastity, poverty, and obedience. What is their purpose? To penetrate once more the world, the saeculum, with the teaching of Christ, and to inspire lay people to live an above average, in fact, a holy life in the world. Their effort, and phenomenally successful, is to influence the leaders of society. Next question. Strange combination. What are clerical secular institutes? The term clerical secular sounds like a contradiction. Well, what are they? Not unlike secular institutes in general, here the members are either priests or ordained deacons. It's been my privilege to organize a secular institute of deacons. This much I can tell you about them. I may have mentioned this on some occasion before. They take vows, but as we know, at least in the United States, most of our permanent deacons are married men. They take, the ones that I have been involved with, take the vows of special devotion to and promoting devotion to the Holy Eucharist, especially exposition of the Blessed Sacrament and prayer among the faithful, even in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, adoration before the Blessed Sacrament. They vow themselves to promote devotion to Our Lady and, in Ignatian fashion, they vow themselves to practice and promote a special loyalty to the Vicar of Christ. However, most secular institutes that are clerical are institutes of priests who, to all intents and purposes, are priests of the diocese, but they bind themselves, these are now the priests, to the three vows that we religious take of consecrated chastity, of consecrated poverty, and of consecrated obedience. And their number is growing widely, including the United States. And the key is that for priests to be bound by the vows of consecrated chastity, poverty, and obedience is priceless in its value in living out their priestly ministry. One priest member of a clerical secular institute was in the community for some time. A priest friend of his and he, from a northern city, thought they'd take a week's vacation in Florida. Their superior found out about it and told them in no uncertain language, "Look, you have taken a vow of consecrated poverty. We do not take vacations." How priests today need to live a consecrated life. And whatever we can do to encourage these our priests in dioceses, at least by private vows, or as members of a formally organized institute, which is called a secular institute, will be blessed by God. Not coincidentally, already back in the late 4th century, St. Augustine, when he became bishop, got the bright idea, let me organize all the priests of my diocese in any society of consecrated life. And to this day, I have never counted them, but I would estimate 1/4 of men's religious institutes follow the rule of St. Augustine, which he drafted for the diocesan priests of his diocese of Hippo. This, by the way, is part of my directives from the Holy See. Whatever can be done to help priests form, become members of an association, whether canonically established or at least in some measure and degree, the priests bind themselves, at least under private vow, to live a life of consecrated chastity, poverty, and obedience. It will help immensely our diocesan priests who in our country are going through the most serious crisis ever in our 500 years of existence since the discovery of the New World. Now, a generic question. Are there new forms of consecrated life arising in the church? And the answer is an emphatic yes. This question deserves not only a human answer in reply, but a semester or 2-semester course. The church desperately, and I mean that adverb literally, the church today desperately needs people, and a growing number of people in every state of life, married, single, those, of course, who are engaged in professions like the legal and medical profession, which is the main reason for the best figure is 14 million abortions. States. Since Vatican II, there have been many new forms of consecrated institutes. And whatever we can do to encourage, especially those who are, let's say, natural leaders, to meet such needs as the church in her 2 millennia of history has never faced. And the key word is consecrated. In other words, people living in the world, I repeat, when I tell this to some audiences, they look at me star-eyed. You mean that we, I, the husband and father of a family, or I, the mother of, say, 7 children, then I can belong to an institute of consecrated life? And I tell them, yes, my dear. Years of conversation with Mother Teresa have fructified in her forming what she calls the lay missionaries of charity, under vow, living according to their state of life. A consecrated life in the world. We are living, and it is not a cliche, in the most demonically dominated society in human history. I quote the chief exorcist of Rome. Ordinary people will not survive. Ordinary bishops, ordinary priests, ordinary religious, ordinary fathers and mothers, ordinary teenagers, ordinary children who are now already in the kindergarten in so many parts of our country are exposed to the most virulent, cleverly called sex education. First graders in grammar school are taught all about homosexuality. And sadly, in some, dare I call them, Catholic schools, yes, a desperate need for organizing those who are Catholic indeed, while they're living in an age and, what a clever term, the New Age. I spoke 2 weeks ago to an audience in Midwestern Ohio on Freemasonry. And for years, I subscribed to the chief English-speaking magazine of Freemasonry called New Age. During the Second Vatican Council, I was told by my Vatican superiors to cooperate with a bishop chosen by the Holy Father to make an in-depth study of Freemasonry. And to cooperate with, correspond with, the chief Freemasons throughout the world. Never did I feel more like a Jesuit. Most dictionaries, look it up, under the word Jesuitical, they will tell you that means clever, that means cunning, that means intriguing. Thanks. The question is, for whom are you intriguing? After a year's correspondence with all the leading Freemasons in the world, we met for 8 hours in the Pittsburgh airport from 9 in the morning till 5 in the evening. And we discussed only one thing which Pope Paul VI wanted answered. Are the Freemasons on principle anti-Catholic? And the answer is, they are. What if Jesuits are cunning or clever or intriguing? Believe you me, so are the Freemasons. Organize. How often the Holy See tells me, 3 rules. Find the strong Catholic believers, train them, and organize them. Next question. What is one strong advice of the Holy Father? How this question needed raising and the answer to be given. We are told by the Vicar of Christ, it is especially to protect us from discouragement. Because of the trials and tension, even the struggle that consecrated life has experienced in our day. Do I say struggle? What a book this would make. On the inhuman cruelty that by now so many dedicated religious have suffered at the hands and the lips and the actions of their own, dare I call them, fellow religious. I'm sure I've told this story before, but it's worth repeating, of a community in the Archdiocese of Detroit. And one of the sisters, after Mass in the morning, they were told they could make their meditation before breakfast, walking around outside the mother house. She noticed something floating on the small, call it pond, artificial lake, with a statue of Our Lady standing in the middle of the waters. She got closer. Then she wrote to me, I screamed. is one of my fellow sisters dressed in the light blue of their community's habit, floating on the waters. Three suicides that one year in that one mother house. And I use the word demonic deliberately because of the demonic pressure from those who had begun to secularize what had once been, I know I used to teach them, a sound religious community. Our Holy Father tells us, don't lose heart. Be courageous. Today is Monday. Am I correct? Saturday I spoke in Louisville. On the four virtues for which we need Jesus Christ in the Eucharist to practice in our day. Charity, chastity, patience, and fortitude. And the title of my conference was The Holy Eucharist, Miracle Worker. We need miracles today to practice the most basic Christian virtues in a society that is, and now again I use the word, in such incredible degree dominated by the evil spirit. Every single contagious disease is controlled by American law. And the doctors must report anyone who has, well, some contagious sickness, except one. The AIDS, the talk about the devil dominating. Not touchable by law. Hundreds of thousands of children are conceived. At conception, they have inherited this disease. And no doctor dare report that to protect sodomy in our once Christian nation. How we need to not, I don't say despair, but even be discouraged. What we see going on in our society, always with God's grace, should inspire us to work far into the night. Pardon me for saying this. I retired this morning after midnight. There are souls to be saved. And now we enter a new section of the Holy Father's document. It is a most unusual, both title and contents. And Jesus Christ and the Trinity. Remember, the focus of both this retreat and the document on which we are basing our conferences, it is consecrated life. Well, there would be no consecrated life as Catholic Christianity understands that term, except for two mysteries of our faith, except for the Holy Trinity, and except for the Incarnation. Except for the Trinity, there could not have been an incarnation. There have to be more than one person in God for the second person to be sent by the first person to become man. And whatever else consecrated life is, and by now a library has been written over the centuries on consecrated life. But there will be no consecrated life unless God had become man. And I repeat what we said earlier. Unless God had become man indeed, that he might die on the cross to redeem us. But God became man to teach us how we are to live. We are to live as far as it is possible with the grace that only God can provide. We are to live as the God-man lived on earth during his visible, physically palpable stay in this valley of tears. One statement of the Holy Father that should be memorized. The core of consecrated life is selfless love. So what is selfless love? Selfless love is the opposite of what the world understands by love. Loving another person another person than whom? Another person than me. That's why God revealed the Holy Trinity. As I keep telling people, God is not a solitary being. God is a community. We read in Scripture, St. John tells us, Deus est amor, God is love. I've taught too much theology to too many people not to know that too many people do not really understand what they may sincerely believe. There cannot be, there could not have been a God who is one person. Why not? Because then God could not have been, notice, love from all eternity. Within the Godhead, there must be, what a statement, there must be another what? Another person, whom then each person in the Trinity can love. The very meaning of love implies, requires, that there be another person whom I'm loving. God did not become love when he created the world, which he did out of love. When teaching the subject, I distinguish between God loving and God being love. God is. You don't use the past tense with God. God is love. He always was. He has to be. There must be another what? Another person. For the very meaning of love to be verified. And Jesus Christ is the incarnation of this divine love. And how we need this lesson. How soon did Christ's enemies want to kill him? How soon? He was just born. And from the moment he was born, he was hated. It took me 50 years in the priesthood. I'm almost boasting now, to learn that if you really love another person, you don't require, what a safe statement, you don't require that other person to love you for you to love him or her. You mean, you're asking, you mean that unlovable persons are to be loved? Yes, that's almost a definition of Christianity. Being human beings, having a spontaneous natural tendency to, oh, what a safe statement, to always see the good in ourselves, and how spontaneously, no effort, to see something we don't like in someone else. And this is the foundation. The Vicar of Christ is speaking. This is the foundation of consecrated life. Loving others, who, as far as we can tell, if they love us, oh, how I wish they would show it. Back to our questions. Is consecrated life a response to a special vocation from God? And the key word there is special. An emphatic yes. Not everyone is called to live a consecrated life. Even to use the word call already implies, on God's part, choosing some persons. But watch it. Choosing them for what? Choosing them to give them extraordinary grace to live out a humanly impossible way of life. Authentically consecrated life is impossible to human nature. Period. Close the book. And that is why Christ chose, as we know, during his visible stay on earth, only certain persons. We call them either disciples or the 12s. Gifted far beyond anyone else. Already, as we know from Abraham on, there were certain people who were called the chosen people. Chosen for what? Chosen to be channels of grace to others. And what happened? After almost 2,000 years of what we call Old Testament history, so far from living up to their special, extraordinary vocation, when the Messiah for whom they were waiting and praying, when he came, what did they do? Shouted to Pontius Pilate, "Crucify him, crucify him." The worst enemies of God in the world. The most devastating persons who have created a havoc over the centuries are the apostates who had once been the chosen people. And the higher the calling to which they were chosen, the more the devil uses such people to undermine and destroy the Church of God. I'll never forget the almost 2-hour conversation in O'Hare Airport in Chicago, arguing, pleading, reasoning with a bishop who had lost his faith. And that is why you handmaids of the precious blood have an extraordinary vocation. As your founder made so clear, the sanctification of priests is indispensable. I'm going to say more than you think. The sanctification of priests is indispensable not just for the well-being, for the very survival of the church in one nation after another. As bishops and priests go, so goes the Catholic Church. As my Vatican superiors have told me more than once, barring a miracle, which we hope for, more than one diocese in the United States will be wiped out. I won't, but I could identify the dioceses in America that are being wiped out. How we need consecrated persons who realize, I don't say just the dignity, but I dare say the indispensability of their being loyal to their consecrated life. We continue. How important, the Holy Father asks, is this special call to consecrated life? You would expect the answer, but we better say it. It is essential. Why? Because no one can give him or herself to the total following of Christ unless they have received the grace. And then the Holy Father's vocabulary, the grace which comes from the Father through Christ and the Holy Spirit whom he has sent. What was the question? The question was, how important is this special call? And there are many, many more vocations to the consecrated life than people are responding to in our country. And the reason is obvious. We in America are living in the wealthiest major nation in the world, the best fed country in the world. What a statement. The sleepiest country in the world. We sleep more, provable by statistics, than any other nation. We are the laziest nation in the world. When I give retreats, as I will next week in Chicago, to lay people who have companies, employers, they tell me the hardest thing is to get 8 hours of work out of your employees. All kinds of, not just, see, an hour off for lunch. They need a tea break or a coffee break or, listen, a television break. and then to have a vocation. And this is what I tell religious, and not just in the United States, but in other countries. In the name of God, your consecrated life should be a mortified life. It should be an ascetical life. It should be a self-denying life. How much we have to learn when Christ spoke of himself and said he did not even have a place around to lay his head. Over the years, I've spent enough sleepless nights in airports where the plane did not leave. Next question. And this is very closely in context. And with this, we will close this meditation. How is the Transfiguration a decisive moment in the life of Christ? Says the Holy Father, it is so decisive because it teaches us there is no glory without the cross. I'll quote the whole reply. You might even say that consecrated life without the cross is a contradiction in terms. Expect the cross. And having lived in the society of Jesus for so many years, you don't have to look too far. As I've told so many people over the years, they commonly identify the cross as a noun. A cross, you know, a cross. Two beams of wood crossing each other. Mother cross is mainly a verb. Have we heard this 1,000 times? Can it be repeated too often? It is the will of God crossing our wills. That, my dear friends, that is consecrated life. And should I say it. And God uses other persons as, well, the providential means of crossing our life. What they want, we don't like. What they don't want, we like. And we're going to teach others what it means to be an authentic follower of Christ. We better we ourselves had better not just tolerate the cross, resign ourselves to the cross, but, and I mean this, love the cross. Why? Because that is what God became man. God became man to have other human beings cross his life. And then, shall I say, to dramatize his experience, they nailed him to a cross. Love the cross because Jesus Christ loves us. And he gives us the cross, and I say this, I repeat now, maybe for the 10th time, from 50 years of priestly experience. Here's one sure, infallible way of becoming a saint. Embrace the cross. Tell the Lord, I love you. I love you, my Jesus. I love you by embracing the cross you are giving me, because that's what you did. In the second station of the way of the cross, you embraced your cross out of love for me. I embrace mine out of love for you. Amen.